Meeting of the House Transportation Finance Committee now comes to order. We do not have a quorum, so we'll wait to do some of the official business till then. But until then, we can start with some of the testifiers. And we'll wait just a minute as they get ready. Well, the first presentations are from the Business Aviation Association, and we have quite a few testifiers here doing that. We have a few that will not be here, but we will introduce them as they come. Right now, we're still dealing with technical issues.
We can start here.
Maybe we can get a chalkboard and some chalk. I mean, that might work.
What a surprise.
Are we? Josh, how close are we?
Sometimes you have to restart.
Okay.
Mr. Gorthoff, if you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. My name is Gordon Huff. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Business Aviation Association. And today is Aviation Day at the Capitol. And we work in close harmony with the Minnesota Aviation Trade Association and the Minnesota Council of Airports, and along with anybody else who is interested in aviation in the state of Minnesota. I noticed that in 1933 the Aeronautics Commission was organized. And I'm doing a little research on the statutes. It looks like April of 1943, we had some extensive comprehensive aviation statutes developed, and then again in 1945, they were updated. But from 1945 to 2013, these statutes were not really updated. They had very few changes, and those that were made were very minimal in the impact. In 1951, the fuel tax went from 4 cents to 5 cents. It's still at 5 cents for the first 50,000 gallons of fuel. And in 1987, the minimum aircraft registration was raised from $10 to $50. After 68 years of being an autopilot, it was a challenge to find a solution that was acceptable to all parties that would be impacted. And I'm talking about the changes we made in 2013, the rather dramatic changes for aircraft registration, the fuel tax, and the eliminating of the sales tax, and the transfer of the aircraft sales tax into the general fund. So these are the along with the commercial flight property tax, these are the major sources of income for the state airport fund. But after 6 years, we did find a solution. We added a provision in that legislation that it should be a report every 4 years to provide a snapshot of as to how the changes are impacting aviation in Minnesota. If changes are needed, we certainly don't want to wait another 68 years before we start to implement them. Today, there are a couple of people who could not be here because of job requirements or the weather. Bemidji Aviation was unable to fly down. And today, though, we have Lynn Boyd with us from MSP Aero.
Thank you, Mr. Hoff. And Mr. Boyd, could you state your name and who you represent for the record, please?
Yes, sir. Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Lynn Boyd. I am one of the owners of MSP Aero. We are an aviation maintenance organization based at Minneapolis Airport. We rent space from Signature Flight Support there. I've been there since 1980. The other owners have been there for long term also. We started our company in 2009 directly as a result of the recession of that time. Gulfstream/General Dynamics Aviation closed the Minneapolis facility, which put 93. Oh, I'm sorry.
Excuse me. Could you pull your mic a little bit closer towards sure. you? It may go in front of the screen, but that helps with the view sound. Thank you.
Gulfstream closed the facility and put 93 people out of work. They were highly skilled, highly paid positions, and many of them found work elsewhere. Our business community, we are specialized avionics, work on the electronics and aircraft, and they actually came to us and asked if we could start a business to keep their business aircraft working. As far as the sales tax impact, when we do a job, we have to bid a job and try and come up with a reasonable price so that the business aviation community wants to use us. Burdened with the 7.875% sales tax of that time, along with the 5% MAC tax or MAC fee, you know, that's a 13% swing over other aviation organizations in the five-state area. So on large jobs, that on a $350,000 job, which was large for us, that would amount to about $45,000. So it was very easy for the business community to fly the aircraft somewhere else and have the work done and still be ahead money-wise. With the relaxation of those, that income tax that we no longer have to charge, obviously we're still faced with the MAC fee, but we work with that. But as a direct result, we did some numbers, and our installation projects have increased by 30%. Our part sales have increased by 45%, and this is all since 2013. We have increased our workforce. In 2013, we had 5 owners and 2 employees, 7 total. And today we have 4 owners and 7 employees for 11 total. We paid out $55,000 to contract laborers in 2013. Last year we paid out $184,000. Furthermore, in 2015 we paid nearly $1 million as wages for contractor services. So since 2013, our combined wages and contractor services has increased by 45%. Obviously, it's hard to know exactly how much of that was due to the sales tax exemptions, but we can certainly say that it helped our business. And that's what I... Are there any questions?
Are there any questions from the committee? Mr. Hoff, or do you have any other presenters at this point?
Yes, Tim Howard from Polaris.
Thank you. If you could come down, please. Appreciate that. And please state your name and who you represent for the record.
Mr. Chair, Representative, hello. My name is Tim Howard. I'm a senior pilot with Polaris Industries. Polaris Industries is a Minnesota-based company with plants all over the world, including in Minnesota facilities in Roseau, Wyoming, Plymouth, and Medina. We operate 2 turboprop King Air B200s and a Jet Citation XLS Plus. We employ 3 full-time pilots and use other qualified contract co-pilots on a regular basis. Polaris started with 1 King Air 90 in 1997 and has grown gradually into a fleet we have today. We push for additional jet aircraft for our fleet with our new plants in Mexico and Alabama. In the old aircraft registration fee system, my first year aircraft registration fee would have been 12% of my aviation budget, and second year would have been 11% of my aviation budget. It's much easier to sell to upper management that the tax would be reduced to $15,000 flat fee, and the tax be based on our fuel usage now. We purchased our first jet, Citation XLS Plus, in December 2014. In our first year with the jet, we used 32,000 gallons of Jet A. 80% of that was purchased in Minnesota. This should increase each year as the jet gets busier. Our King Airs have been a workhorse for the company for over 18 years, flying our managers and engineers from plant to plant. It's a 7 to 8 hour drive to Roseau, Minnesota. So if an employee's engineer is heading up there, he's going to lose 2 days of productivity of work just to work one day. We depart at 6 in the morning, they're at work by 8, leave there at about 4:30, and they're back home by 6. We have a scheduled shuttle that flies a minimum 3 days a week. 90% of all the King Air flights take place in the state of Minnesota. In each of the last 3 years, the King Airs have purchased over 50,000 gallons of Jet A in the state of Minnesota alone. Although the amount of savings in the King Air is not as imposing as the jet, we are still saving over $6,500 a year in our King Air operation. As a company and as a manager, we appreciate that our budget is controlled by usage and fuel, not by an incredibly high registration fee, which in all honesty is hard to justify in a lean environment. When the economy is down or a company is struggling, the first thing they look at is the travel expenses. It's a lot easier to cut a fixed cost of $125,000 than a variable that is associated with the aircraft usage. Thank you. Any questions?
Any questions for Mr. Howard? Thank you, Mr. Howard. We appreciate your testimony. Do we have other testifiers?
I do have some testimonies that I'd like to read, if that would be all right, Mr. Chair. Due to work and due to weather, there were three that were unable to be here today.
Go ahead.
All right.
please state their name for the record, yes, and represent Duke.
Michael Lawrence is the general manager of Key Air Twin Cities. Dear Transportation Committee members, as an operator of a full-service FBO facility at the Anoka County Airport, I have a few comments regarding the changes to the aviation statutes of 2013. Our company is headquartered in Connecticut and for many years have benefited from the high sales and use taxes on the business aircraft in the surrounding states. He's referring to the Connecticut surrounding states, not Minnesota. Because of this, I was part of the lobbying group wanting to see positive changes in Minnesota to improve the atmosphere for using business aircraft. After many attempts to find middle ground, the registration fees were reduced while increasing the jet fuel tax. In my personal opinion, this was a small step in the right direction, but unlikely to show dramatic effects in the short run. We still remain near the top in the country for the cost to own and operate business aircraft. While we have a great system of airports and navigational aids, business and general aviation continue to carry a disproportionate financial burden of an aviation system used heavily by the airlines. The benefit to the airlines by reducing congestion at MSP Airport and the benefits to the rural communities only accessible by general aviation does not seem to be fairly recognized by the costs and fees to general aviation. I implore you to continue to investigate legislative options to balance the aviation funding system to create a more competitive environment fostering growth in all aspects of aviation in Minnesota. Sincerely, Michael Lawrence, General Manager, Key Air Aviation.
Thank you. And you have a couple more?
I do. I actually just received this one. I'm going to try to read it off my iPad. Dear Mr. Chairman, to the Minnesota House Transportation Committee, first and foremost, thank you for taking time to learn more about the issue impacting business aviation in the state of Minnesota. As you hear testimony regarding the value of business aviation and general aviation, I'd like to share some key pieces of information from a PricewaterhouseCoopers survey completed last year reporting on 2013 economic impact. As a whole, the general aviation industry, inclusive of business aviation, supports 1.1 million jobs throughout the United States. These jobs are spread between direct employment, which is to say those of us whose livelihoods are a result of working in aviation, as well as indirect, induced, and enabled jobs. These jobs include hospitality industries, hotels, restaurants, etc., along with jobs enabled by general aviation. You see, when business aviation brings money to a Minnesota community, it's not just supporting the jobs at the airport. Spending is occurring at local businesses, and that spending allows those local businesses to grow further and for the community to continue to grow as more jobs are added and those employees do things like buy groceries, cars, and houses. Minnesota has an aviation infrastructure to be proud of, but we can't rest on our laurels and let that be enough. We have to be vigilant in maintaining our high standards as a strong general aviation industry fosters growth, development, and investment within the state. WIP Air's 50-plus year history begins not with floats, but with business aviation. Our founder, Ben Whipplinger, outfitted some of 3M's first business aircraft some 10 years prior to developing our now world-famous Whipline floats. Businesses like ours will not grow and thrive in states that do not value general aviation. WIP Air has grown to over 200 employees, comprised of aviation maintenance technicians, avionics installers, painters, upholsters, administrative specialists, accountants, marketers, and fabricators. We are proud to be part of a $2.6 billion contribution to the GDP that Minnesota makes, along with the 6,700 direct jobs within the state of Minnesota. Across the state, general aviation supports over 26,000 jobs, and Minnesota ranks within the top 10 states for per capita output. Keeping our state general aviation industry strong is important for many reasons. A thriving industry means that we will keep developing skilled workforce to support our international growth. It means that we keep these jobs and investments here in Minnesota. Accomplishments such as Whippair's work has been mostly in international customers in recent years, so we have not experienced as a direct result an impact as other businesses may have had, and cannot quantify the value of this work at Whippair. I think she's referring to the lowering of the sales tax there and eliminating of the sales tax, I should say, on parts and labor. Nevertheless, we support all efforts to get Minnesota an attractive place to own, operate, store, and maintain aircraft of all sizes. And I'm not going to get this, I don't think I'm going to get this up and running on the, there's a PowerPoint presentation by Bemidji Aviation. Oh, you got it up?
While we're doing that, I will call this meeting to order. We do have a quorum now, so this meeting will come to order. We can do that. Representative Hornstein, have you have a moment to review our minutes?
Yes, I would move that we approve the minutes, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein moves that we approve the minutes of Monday, March 21st.
No, 14th.
March 14th. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. Minutes are approved.
Do we have copies?
Yes, we do have copies, so we could continue.
Yeah, I think we should go ahead.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Ms. Tracy Walter, Bemidji Aviation Vice President, is unable to be here today because of the snow that is in Bemidji, and she had something to get back for, and she was worried that they would get down here, but they would not be able to get back home. So
certainly.
She apologizes for not being able to be here. Mr. Chairman and members, you have this now in front of you, I hope, but Tracy Walter is the Vice President of Bemidji Aviation Services. They are a full-service FBO charter company and aviation maintenance provider based at the Bemidji Regional Airport. Just to give you a brief history of Bemidji Aviation, they have been an employee-owned since 2007 with roots going back to 1970. The average employee earns over $40,000 per year. Bemidji Aviation owns 40 aircraft, and they are the largest Part 135 operator in the state of Minnesota. Slide 3. Bemidji Aviation has pilots and aircraft based in 5 states, including Minnesota cities Bemidji, Detroit Lakes, Alexandria, Duluth, Eveleth, Marshall, Thief River Falls, and the Twin Cities area. In 2013, Bemidji Aviation, along with others in this room, asked for a decrease in aircraft registration fees and sales tax on parts and aircraft used for commerce, where flying the aircraft is the business. The legislature listened, and the law was passed in favor of keeping Minnesota aviation friendly. With the law that became effective on July 1st, 2014, Bemidji Aviation Service has saved an average of $72,000 annually. They are keeping their corporate offices and major maintenance bases in Bemidji, keeping their employees in Minnesota, in their homes, and in our communities, making Minnesota nice, nice. In contrast, last year, one of Bemidji Aviation's largest competitors moved their entire corporate office from California to Texas, largely because of the offensive tax environment of California. Bemidji Aviation's biggest desire then and now is to grow Bemidji Aviation's regional air freight department, and with the tax and registration relief provided, they are able to accomplish that goal. Slide 4. In May of last year, they expanded their operation by one-third, opening a base in Colorado, and now are operating 5 aircraft in Colorado, Kansas, and Nebraska. Next slide, 5. Growing outside of Minnesota, but bringing the money back to Minnesota. I asked Tracy really what that meant, and she said, you know, we do make a profit on those 5 airplanes based outside of Minnesota, and those profits come back here to Minnesota. Bemidji Aviation in slide 6 is also now equipping their aircraft fleet with top-notch glass panels and GPS, along with other FAA-mandated equipment due by January 1st, 2020. These improvements greatly enhance their safety performance during operations. And lastly, Ms. Walter would like to thank the legislature for decreasing the cost of doing business as an aviation company in Minnesota. It has kept valuable companies such as those you see here today providing good-paying jobs in Minnesota. So, as I think that's all the testimony I have, Mr. Chair, and I want to thank you for giving us the opportunity. This is our 5th Aviation Day at the Capitol, and we hope to continue this to make sure that even though we are a small part of the transportation plan, and we are a dedicated fund, we hope that it'll stay dedicated to the aeronautics fund and not used for other purposes in the future.
Thank you for your testimony, and thank you for keeping our skies safe and air traffic still one of the safest in the world, and we do appreciate the industry here in the state of Minnesota. Before you do leave, I just want to open up for one more opportunity for questions from the committee on any of the testifiers or information presented at this point. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I came just a little late, so I apologize if you covered this already, but is the idea here to ask the major airlines to pay more? Do you feel that they're not paying their fair share on the fees and some of these other? I saw in one of your handouts that you know, you're paying, they're getting the benefits type of arrangement.
Mr. Hoff,
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, I would not say we're here to ask that the airlines pay more or that we pay less. When we passed this legislation, the airlines asked that there would be no changes to the statutes that they operate under, and we honored that request, and we continue to honor that. We're just here, as I said earlier when you were not here, that it took 68 years before we had this major change from 1945 to 2013. We do not want to go another 68 years without looking at how are we funding our state airport fund. Is it adequate? Is it meeting the needs of the aviation industry across the state? We have 129 airports outside of the greater Minnesota area, and then, well, actually 7, but there's one that's not part of the MAC, but there are 6 airports in the MAC system. Yeah. So I would not say that we are here to ask that the airlines pay more and that we pay less.
Representative Horstein?
No, thanks. I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you. Any other questions from the committee? Well, again, thank you for your testimony and all of the testifiers that came before us. Is a representative from Minnesota Department of Transportation here, Cassandra? Thank you. If you could come to the table, please, and identify yourself and who you represent for the record, please. And I think we do have a hard copy of that presentation as well, so if you could refer from there, it'd be great.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
My name is Cassandra Isaacson. I'm the Director of Aeronautics for the Minnesota Department of Transportation. And I do have some slides prepared for you. I understand we're having technical difficulties, so as I flip through them, I'll tell you the slide number. And I know that you have a couple of bills that you want to hear yet this afternoon, and so I'll move pretty quickly, but I'm certainly willing to answer questions as we go. So slide one is just a little bit about MnDOT Aeronautics. I believe you heard earlier that the Minnesota Aeronautics Commission was founded in the 30s. For most of the last century, aeronautics was a standalone department, and then in the 70s, as was true sort of across the country, DOTs began to form where they consolidated highway agencies, aeronautics agencies, and so on, and that was true in Minnesota as well. There is an entire chapter of state law, Chapter 360, dedicated to airports and aeronautics. Many as issues evolve, things like drones, unmanned aircraft, there's plenty of law in Chapter 360 to investigate and talk about with those things. The next slide, which would be slide three, we divide the airport system into three categories of airports in Minnesota. There's 135 what we would call public airports, so those are publicly owned, funded by the public, and they're spread across the state. The largest category are the airports a lot of folks might think of, the Duluths, the Rochesters, but on the state system includes landing strips, so turf runways. There's still quite a few of those out there as well. One slide that I really wanted to point out to you is slide number four, and it's quick facts. And this is some information I asked some folks in our office to put together that sort of explains the ownership of airports in the state of Minnesota. And so the number that I'd really like to highlight for you is that 55% of the airports in the state are owned by a city with a population less than 5,000 people. Nearly 20% of the airports are owned by a city with a population less than 1,000 people. So these are truly municipal airports, you know, what we think of as a mini airport, but small communities, small towns all across Minnesota that are the owners of these facilities. On the next slide, kind of shifting a bit, so that's kind of the state system. I thought it was important to share with you some information today regarding how federal funding flows to airports, because ultimately the state airports fund, the stability of it, how far those state dollars go, is a function of how the federal money flows to airports as well. For airports in the United States, you either get primary entitlements from the federal government or non-primary. And basically the difference is a primary airport would have airline service, and they would have at least 10,000 enplanements per year. And so that means that they get $1 million a year from FAA for airport projects. If you don't have airline service, or even if you do have airline service and you have fewer than 10,000 enplanements a year, you get $150,000. So that's the gap. And so there are airports, it's not uncommon, in 1 year they might get $1 million, but they don't have enough enplanements, and so their formula changes to that 150. And so that's the way that federal formula works today. So most of what I'm going to tell you on this next piece is the non-primary piece, so the smaller airports, the ones that are getting $150,000 a year. In order to be eligible for that, they need to demonstrate they have $750,000 worth of projected need. So they need to show $750,000 worth of projects to FAA. FAA will give them $150,000 a year up to 4 years. When you do that math, that means they get $600,000 from FAA for $750,000 worth of work. And so ultimately that means state and local government have to find a way to accomplish those projects. Not too long ago, back in November, FAA issued a report to Congress, and you'll find some highlights from that on page 6 on some of the impact of that. And what has happened is $150,000 is not really enough money to do a substantial project of any kind on an airport. There's runways, pavement, buildings, all those kinds of things. And so they carry that money forward. So in year one, they have $150,000. The next year, they have $300,000, then $450,000, then $600,000. They are allowed to, if they don't have a project, they're allowed to transfer that money to another airport. However, once they get to that $600,000, it's really hard for a community with less than 5,000 people to make a decision to transfer $600,000 of federal money to someone else. And so as a result, what's happened over time is that on the whole, that national money, airports end up choosing having to choose projects that are perhaps a lower priority, lower cost, and then the higher priority projects, they have to break them up into really small pieces, which then adds 15% to the what the project should have been had they been able to do it all at one time. And so that sort of, the way that federal money is working has a direct impact on the state airports fund. And you'll see that on slide 7, the kind of how those things play out. And so projects broken up, transferring of entitlements, all of those sorts of things. It makes it very challenging for us to leverage the federal money. Just the way that federal money is structured, it's very challenging to actually leverage it. As we go forward on slide 8, you'll see the sources of revenue that go into the State Airports Fund. The sales tax on aircraft is a new revenue source to the fund. That was part of the testimony you heard earlier a few years ago when the taxes were restructured. That is a new source of revenue, but ultimately the fund itself, it's a bit different than the way we typically think of funds in state government, in that typically the revenues go up and down with a fund, and then you determine your appropriations based on how much might be in that fund. This particular fund has a shock absorber built in with it, and that is the airline flight property tax. So as other revenues go up, airline flight property tax would go down. There's a connection to the appropriation with this fund, and so it doesn't operate quite the same as some of the other funds might. This is the 2016 forecast for the State Airports Fund, and you can see total, as you look forward, total resources and total expenditures, those tend to remain tight, and that's because of that airline flight property tax being the shock absorber. The other thing to know in terms of the differences is MnDOT does have a fund balance policy for this fund. We instituted to basically put a ceiling and a floor so that we have enough reserve, but then we also wouldn't, the fund wouldn't artificially grow. We would make recommendations associated with that. So slide 10 is what I want to talk to you a bit about. So I mentioned the challenges with federal funding, and ultimately the question then is, well, MnDOT, what the heck are you doing about that? Some of the things that we've been doing, and in part it was actually our ability to do some of these things, is because of the $15 million that was restored back to the State Airports Fund. We worked with the airports across the state. The legislature agreed to provide, to spend that $15 million over 4 years. State fiscal year 17 will be the fourth year of that $15 million spend. One of the things that we have done is we are participating in the federal project. So a typical match would be a 90-10. So federal money 90, local 10. We've been putting in 5%, so 90 federal, 5 state, 5 local. And we've also made some adjustments in our maintenance and operations grants. And actually, if you go ahead and go to the next slide. And so what does that mean? So in state fiscal year 15, we issued 135 state grants. Nearly 70% of those were less than $40,000 each. In state fiscal year 16, we issued fewer grants, but they were for higher dollar amounts. And so that means that we're doing larger projects that are better leveraging the federal money. So instead of doing those tiny incremental projects, the cities were able to do some larger projects that were a bit more meaningful. You can go to the next one. The other thing that we have done is we've permanently adjusted our formula for maintenance and operations grants. So this is money that goes to an airport, for example, to help pay the salary of the snowplow driver that plows the runway. This is truly the maintenance and operations costs of the airports. To give you a little bit of math there, our smallest grant that we give to airports is $4,300 a year. The largest is $200,000. It's a formula based on the size of the airport, the amount of runway they have, all of those kinds of things. The median is $19,000. So that means that of the 135 airports in the state, most of them are receiving less than $20,000 a year in maintenance and operations grants. And that's current. When we did our increase from 2/3 to 75% and adjusted our formula, some airports maybe received a few thousand dollars more a year. That generated numerous emails saying thank you. We received a handwritten thank you note on one of our grant amendments. Those, you know, in MnDOT and in state government, these $19,000 doesn't sound like a tremendous amount of money. For a lot of these communities, for the airports, it actually really is. It makes a huge difference. And so being able to do that, that $15 million getting restored back to the state airports fund, has really meant a lot to the airports in the state. Finally, there was on your agenda, it mentions the aviation tax report is due in June. We've been working on that. We're working with the Department of Revenue on it. It will have those the revenues and expenditures, so there'll be a good bit of detail in that. And we anticipate that it'll be delivered in time. We've been putting together data. There haven't really been any big surprises. Things are going as I think folks forecast. And then just finally, a little commercial. There's quite a few big aviation events coming up in the state, quite a few good conferences. And this summer, if you have a hankering for a pancake, I am sure there is a pancake breakfast and fly-in at an airport near you. Those are great family events. And MnDOT's website, if you click the airplane and you go to MnDOT's website, you'll find the aeronautics page. And we have a list of all of those events that are occurring around the state. So encourage folks to attend. Be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Isaacson. I just have just one question before the committee. Through your work and review of this, the whole airport system and so forth, have you seen any glaring deficiencies that we should be aware of that we may not have seen up to this point?
Mr. Chairman, I think deficiencies in terms of the infrastructure funding?
Any of them.
I would say that what we've observed as we've been looking at the way the federal money works, the state money works, that sort of thing, I think that ultimately, for a long time, I think people thought there wasn't a big need for the airports. The airports are as old as the roads. There's the history of how airports developed is very similar to how highways developed. They started out in the mud. They eventually paved. There's a lot of infrastructure out there that's aging. There's no doubt about that, so cost increase. Once we started participating in the federal projects, all of a sudden, the nature of the projects we were receiving, that those requests, and so I think ultimately local government was struggling to find the resources at the local level to match that federal money. And so that because of the $15 million, we've been able to participate going forward. Time will tell if we're able to continue to do that. I suspect not, certainly not at a 5% rate, knowing that that money also goes to maintenance and operations.
Thank you. I think we do have a few questions. Representative Hull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'd like to commend your department for making sure that the federal entitlement dollars gets moved around to the different airports to make sure we don't lose any of those funds. I use the St. Cloud Airport as a kind of an example, but can you explain to the committee why that airport struggles to get those federal dollars and what possibly could be done to maybe get them to allow to maybe be in the mix for the federal dollars that seem the other airports like Rochester and Duluth receive?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative. So for airports, the federal formula lays out the entitlements, and then what happens is airports all across the country, airports have a certain date by which they have to say whether or not they're going to do a project that year. The money doesn't just stay in a bank account. What happens is that FAA uses all of the money that wasn't used for projects to fund their discretionary pot. Airports in Minnesota, sort of across the board, have actually not been competing well for discretionary, and it's for not a great reason, and that's that we've actually done a pretty good job of maintaining our pavements. Several years ago, the legislature approved bonding for us to do pavement work at the airports across the state. FAA tends to invest that discretionary money from the runway out, so a terminal building, some of those kinds of things, they just don't compete as well. But ultimately, the across the board, and you would, I can share that report that FAA did to Congress. It's not just a Minnesota issue, it's a national issue, and the way that money is distributed and then the airports being able to get enough money together to do a project, it's very difficult. I think that depending, a lot of times when an airport attracts discretionary money, it's because it happens to hit one of the targets that FAA is after, which is particularly related to safety or runway out. I think the days of us seeing a discretionary project, FAA giving an airport discretionary money for a terminal building or something like that, I just don't see that happening in the near term.
Thank you. Representative Howell, any follow-up? Okay, I think we have one more. Representative Hornstein has a question, but we do have two more bills yet to do, too, and I'm sure you'll be available for questions afterwards.
Yes.
But Representative Hornstein.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. So on page 4, your slide number 8, where you have the nice graphics, on the airline flight property tax, you know, so these property taxes tend to fluctuate, and is there a need for the legislature to make sure that we keep this at a historical norm, you know, because I imagine these fluctuations would cause some heartburn, to quote Representative Veard, in the state airports fund. So is there a need for the legislature to keep this at historic norms, and does it go like that?
Ms. Isaacson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hornstein, actually the airline flight property tax results in the fund not doing that.
Right.
So the way it works is once the appropriation is set, so let's say that the legislature determines in state fiscal year 18, you're going to say, okay, the appropriation will be $20 million. We start collecting revenue, we forecast the revenue we're going to collect, and let's say we're going to collect $15 million from all other sources, the airlines would pay $5 million. So we're kind of guaranteed to hit the appropriation. The taxes follow the appropriation for that airline piece. In terms of should it be standard, should there be a ceiling, should there be a floor, those are, I think, policymaker decisions. We can certainly provide information. I think the airlines would certainly want to be part of a conversation if there was a ceiling and a floor. But ultimately, I've been working really hard in the last few years to help the airports understand we have to do a better job on the whole with long-range planning for airports so that we're better able to demonstrate to the legislature what those needs are. So then you understand that if the airport community comes to you with a request to increase the appropriation, which in effect would have an impact on what the airlines pay, that you know that there is an actual need there and it's not just wishful thinking.
Representative Hornstein.
Thank you very much. Thanks for that very good explanation. And you're correct. This is something that the legislature would have to do. This isn't something the agency can do. Do you feel that, I mean, either now or in the near future, I mean, we should be taking this up, we should be looking at this. Is there a need for the legislature to address this floor ceiling issue?
Ms. Isaacson?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't think we'll be making any recommendations in this next report, in this first report, to make changes. As we work with the airports over the next 2 years to really look at what is that, are there big projects in the next 5 years? For example, one of the things I've been telling the airports, you know, if in 2019 you are going to be coming and asking for bonding, let me know that now so that as we enter into the biennial budget process, we can collect that information. And so I think that in another year or two, I'll have a much better answer for you for that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Isaacson, and thank you to the department for presenting that information. And we'll be looking for those reports.
Sure.
We really appreciate the airline industry. So thank you very much. With that, I think we're going to go a little bit out of order. And I think, and I'll turn over to the chair here.
We're going to take a few minutes. Got to do that. Okay. Representative Fabian, are you ready to present?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, I never did get my glasses. Thank you.
So, should we do the amendment right away?
Yeah.
Welcome, Representative Fabian, and I will move House File 3014. I understand there is a technical amendment. I did talk with Representative Hornstein before this, and you're okay with the technical amendment?
Yes, sorry. Absolutely.
So I will move the A1 amendment. Members, it's a line item 1.2. We're adding in code of federal regulations, Title 49, Part 1, 571, and successor requirements. So that is the amendment to get that in the proper. Mr. Burris, do you have any comments on the technical amendment?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, that change is essentially just a clarification of what motor vehicle safety federal regulations, where they're located. So it's adding citation language. And then, Mr. Chair, I'm not sure if you're working off of a version that has a second change as well.
I wasn't here when she
said. Oh, sure. 1.4. Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, members, the second change is on page 4, line 3, and it is a cleanup of how the language should read on a provision around motorcycle riding rules and cases where there would be an exception to requirements around sitting aside a straddle, which doesn't apply in situations where there's car-like seating.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burris. That is the amendment. Any questions on the amendment? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Fabian, two-year bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. Just a real quick history. In 1954, there was a company that started in Roseau, Alan and Edgar Hattin, along with David Johnson, started Polaris. And ever since then, the company has been doing some amazing things. They produce a wide variety of vehicles, snowmobiles, ATVs, you name it, side-by-sides, and now we're seeing the slingshot. And I don't know if you've had an opportunity to see a slingshot. We had tried to make arrangements today to have one out here in the circle, but because of the weather and so forth, it didn't happen. But we will make one available to you in the future. What House File 3014 is about the Polaris slingshot and other vehicles that may be similar to that in the future. Right now, in order to be able to drive a slingshot, you have to have a motorcycle endorsement. Polaris has worked diligently across the country with state and federal agencies trying to come up with language that will allow consumers to not have to have a motorcycle endorsement. Instead, they would be able to use their regular driver's license to drive the slingshot. What makes the slingshot different from some other trikes or motorcycles, obviously, is the fact, I mean, it has three wheels, but what we're doing here is making some definitions that you have to have seats to sit in, not a straddle, steering wheel, anti-lock brakes, three wheels, some of those things to try to make it easier for consumers to get their hands on one of these toys that we like to make in Roseau. So with that, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. J.R. Burke, who's worked tirelessly on this with a wide variety of people all across the country here in the state of Minnesota. And you can have at it.
Mr. Burke, please introduce yourself to the committee.
Chairman Kelly, members of the committee, my name is J.R. Burke, and I am the manager of state and provincial government relations for Polaris Industries. We're a Medina-based power sports manufacturer. Dan would still like us to be Roseau-based, of course. But we have over 3,000 employees here in Minnesota. We've got over 60 dealers themselves, accounting for over 500 employees. And in fact, Minnesota is our largest business partner in relation to the suppliers that we have, even as a global company. So we're very proud of our footprint here in Minnesota. whether it be in Roseau, Medina, Wyoming, or anywhere else across the state where we have operations. In November 2014, Polaris launched Slingshot. As a product described in your materials, it's designed and manufactured in accordance with federal motor vehicle safety standards for motorcycles. The motorcycle is distributed by 14 independently owned Polaris dealers across the state, touching all parts of Minnesota. Since we went to market with that product, it's been titled and registered in Minnesota as a motorcycle, and operators have been required to carry a motorcycle endorsement over to in order to legally operate it. And while it's legal in Minnesota, House File 3014 seeks to create this vehicle as a subtype of motorcycle, as well as that for other similarly configured products that it would fall under. We agree with this approach for three primary reasons. First, it adds appropriate levels of prescriptiveness for these types of motorcycles that retains consistency between its state and federal classification. The federal government looks at vehicles pretty simplistically, frankly. Anything less than four wheels is considered a motorcycle. So these naturally fall into that category and comply with the federal motor vehicle safety standards for motorcycles. It's important for these products as well. Despite being unique from handlebar and straddle seat motorcycles, these vehicles come with a 17 character VIN just like your regular automobile does, a compliance label, and a manufacturer statement of origin, which federal government requires us to put a body type on and then refer back to a federal classification through the 17 character VIN, all of which are motorcycle. Second, the House file resolves some practical considerations that exist today under the current definition. Customers increasingly walk into our dealers across the state without a motorcycle endorsement or a permit, and they can't even test drive one of these. So it's a barrier to entry to these small, independently owned dealers who are trying to grow their business off of innovative, safe products. Additionally, there is a practical consideration of how to accommodate skills testing for these types of vehicles in traditional motorcycle skills training facilities, in addition to the fact that the types of skills that are being tested for in those motorcycle skills courses are not the same sorts of skills that you're using in order to operate a Slingshot or another autocycle. Finally, the definition ensures that registered autocycles will meet federal safety standards, which Slingshot actually exceeds, with crash avoidance features like traction and stability control, a drag torque mitigation system where the rear wheel will actually feather in order to make sure that the vehicle stays in line regardless of conditions or operator inputs, a steel-reinforced frame with crumple zones, steel-reinforced roll hoops over the operator and other occupants, and the three-point safety harness. The House file achieves these goals while providing what we believe to be providing the Department of Public Safety adequate flexibility to regulate these types of motorcycles. Mr. Chairman, members, it's for these reasons that Polaris requests favorable consideration of House File 3014. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have, and I appreciate your time.
Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the testifier, I'm just wondering, I've owned, I believe, eight or maybe more Polaris vehicles in my short time on Earth here, but I'm just wondering, where is this vehicle manufactured? You didn't say specifically. I buy Polaris products because they're made in Minnesota. Can you clarify that for us?
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sundin, the vehicle is manufactured in Spirit Lake, Iowa, just south of the Minnesota border, northwest Iowa.
Okay.
Representative Sundin.
Your automobiles are registered with a graduated fee for registration. I don't know how motorcycles are, and I don't know how this is going to fit in, and maybe you can't even tell me, but that's value-based, I understand, as far as plate registrations, that type of thing. So how is that going to fit into that fee structure?
Mr. Burke.
Vehicles.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sundin, I would probably defer to DPS to speak more specifically to that, but the way that the bill is structured is that it would, as I mentioned, refer to these autocycles as a subtype of motorcycle. Therefore, the applicable downfield blocking has already been accomplished because of the existing motorcycle regulations, statutes, and so on, so that this vehicle would fall and be subject to those that are applicable, including registration fees and otherwise.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Thanks for the presentation. So I was looking at the automotive features piece here, and you know, my concern is always with safety. And so I see that you have seat belts. I see that there are mirrors, rear view and side view mirrors. There's blinkers. I understand that there's the legislation that's being proposed in Utah has some requirements to make sure that seat belts are worn, minors wear helmets, that there's blinkers, mirrors, etc. Would you be open to having that type of safety regimen for Minnesota and for this particular legislation? I mean, I think it's great to, I mean, this is clearly a separate category, so we need to do something here. So thank you for bringing the bill, Representative Fabian. And it is a hybrid. I mean, you've got motorcycle features, you've got automotive features, but I just want to just make sure that it's done safely. People should have fun, but do it safely. So what do you think?
Mr. Burke, or Representative Fabian, either one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Hornstein. We do, and I've conferred, and by the way, thank you to Mr. Burris. He's been very helpful in this process as well. We would continue the current practice that's required of a motorcycle. If you're under the age of 18, you'd be required to wear a helmet either as a passenger or as the driver. You know, I know a lot of 17-year-olds would like to drive one of these, but and then we would also continue the practice of eye protection. To the point of the seat belts, I'm not sure that that's addressed in the bill.
Okay. Representative Hornstein.
Well, just thank you. And if it's not, would you be open to having something related to seatbelts?
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hornstein, what I can say is Polaris always errs on the side of safety when it comes to our products, including this particular vehicle. As I mentioned, they come with a three-point harness. We, as you can see in all these materials in our owner's manuals, as well as our compliance labels and in-vehicle warning labels, we do encourage, despite existing law, helmet use, you know, to use seat belts. They are available, obviously, to wear eye protection and so on and so forth. I would leave that to the discretion of the legislature to determine what beyond is currently in the bill would make it consistent with those warnings.
Well, Mr. Chair, thanks. I'll just talk with Representative Fabian offline a little bit about this and, you know, see if we can beef up some of that language. But I'm glad that you're somewhat neutral on that, so that gives us a little bit of wiggle room, I think.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a little bit of clarification. How fast can these vehicles go would be one, and are they safe to use on all roads?
Mr. Burke.
Chairman Kelly, Representative, we do not publish top speed for our products. They can certainly maintain safe highway speeds. They do have a 2.4-liter General Motors engine in them, so they are a proven on-highway motor that's being used in this product. And yes, indeed, these vehicles are safe for operation on all roadways. The vehicles are equipped with the similar types of tires that you would find on regular passenger vehicles. So, you know, they've got a flat tread. They have, 35 PSI of air pressure. They operate very similar to the type of tire that, you know, you either drove your vehicle here to today in or operate on the weekends or whatever.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just asking for a clarification. This bill is interesting to me from another angle in that I've got constituents who are interested in purchasing the Elio. And as I shared with Representative Fabian this morning, he's kind of a faster guy than I am. And the Elio is a more mellow vehicle and goes slower. But Mr. Burris, we've been in communication. I just want to affirm today in the hearing that the Elio would also be covered in this legislation.
Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, yes, I believe so. From the last time, which was pretty recently, that I reviewed the proposed specs for an Elio, I think it would fit under the same auto cycle classification.
Representative Johnson, just as an update, our staff has been in touch with Elio, and they are satisfied with this language, okay, that it would apply to them.
Mr. Chair, one more question.
Yes.
In terms of eye protection and helmets, would that be also required for the Elio, but that sort of thing?
Representative Fabian?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Johnson. I believe because on the Elio, it's an enclosed cab, it has a different set of safety standards. Obviously, you wouldn't have to wear the eye protection, and I don't believe you'd have to wear the helmet either. But Mr. Burris, I know we've talked about this a little bit, and maybe you can help out in the committee.
Mr. Burris?
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. An enclosed cab auto cycle would not carry the same helmet requirements or eye protection requirements under this legislation.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just finally, thanks for bringing forward. Really, this is an issue that is important to a couple of my constituents. They don't drive motorcycles, but they want to purchase, in this case, an Elio, and it just makes good sense. Thanks a lot.
Mr. Chair, if I may, please.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that it's important. You know, one of the people in the hallways talked to me, and, oh, you're doing this for Polaris. Granted, Polaris brought the idea, but Polaris is not carving out a narrow box for themselves. They're working throughout the country trying to, and if Arctic Cat in my district wants to start building something that complies with these or somebody else, they certainly are welcome to join the market.
Sorry. Thank you. Representative Ugel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Koznick and myself both ride motorcycles in this group, and I was fortunate enough to take a test drive in this particular vehicle, the Slingshot. And I can assure you that it is a hybrid. It's really a cross between a car and a motorcycle. It's very safe. It stops just like a high-performance car would, with analog brakes, and it corners extremely well. And Representative Fabian has alluded to the fact that it does accelerate well also, very well, in fact. But I think this vehicle provides, and vehicles like it, provide the opportunity for many, many people to experience motorcycle riding, but yet not have to worry about essentially tipping over or having some of the more common accidents that motorcycles have. So this opens up a whole new area for a whole new consumer group, and they're very popular, very, very popular. I think it's entirely appropriate that it does have a separate category because not everybody can pass a motorcycle safety test. And in this case, it's impossible for this machine to go through the cone test where you have to maneuver your motorcycle through a series of cones to demonstrate proficiency in turning and curvy roads and things like that. This is just simply too big for that to happen. Being side by side, being four or five on the floor, I forget what it was, really gives you a wonderful experience. But yet again, eye protection and other things like that are important because you are out in the air and you're experiencing many of the same feels and the exhilaration of motorcycling. So I think it's a wonderful product. Its time is now, and I think we're going to see more of them. And it should have a separate category like Representative Fabian's bill is proposing. Thank you.
Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, this isn't anything I've ever given thought to before, but actually I owned a motorcycle at one point in my life.
Okay.
I'm not a fan of two-wheeled. I didn't do so well on it, and I'm not very good with a bike either, but I try. But I see as people getting older, and as you say, this is maybe a different way for, you know, the people who have issues with balance. And, you know, this is interesting. So I really appreciate this coming forward again. It's not anything I would have thought of. But I do just have to weigh in as someone who's been a fan of seatbelts for many years. This just seems to me, if it's a vehicle produced and made with a three-point buckle, we should require it. We have an opportunity right now at the time we're drafting some really important legislation to do the right thing rather than waiting and coming back and having this fight. This is it is a hybrid. It's made with seatbelts. The seatbelt should be used. And so to get my support, you're going to need to do that. But it may not make a difference whether I buy one at one time, because the seatbelt will be there for me. But I know the data on traffic safety, and I know the different seatbelts have made saving lives, and I think we should take this opportunity to put this in this bill.
Thank you. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a comment that I have is that the majority of the bill really has minor changes to it, but the big thing that is being asked of this is how we determine who is licensed to drive it. And I think that we need to go back to the understanding of why there's a difference between a motorcycle endorsement and a regular car endorsement. From everything that I know about this vehicle, you drive it just like a car. It doesn't lean per se, and it has the same width in front. Matter of fact, if it's coming towards you from the road, it's going to look like a car. And all of the issues related to driving and keeping the vehicle under control would be more applicable to a car than it would be to a motorcycle. And so, to me, it seems reasonable for us to expect that the license itself would be more representative of a driver's license without a motorcycle endorsement than with it. So that's why I think this bill is certainly appropriate for this particular vehicle and types like it, rather than being a motorcycle, which I think is the primary reason for this. So I do support it. I think we always have issues of safety, and we need to hold each other accountable for our own actions in regards to that safety. So thank you for bringing this forward.
Thank you. And members, we do have one more bill that we will get to today. And so I think that's the end of our questions. And this bill is being referred to public safety, so you do have some opportunities there to also, if you have some other concerns, that they will be taking up there as well. So Representative Fabian, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do want to allow Mr. Burke to make one more comment, if I may.
Mr. Burke.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, to your point there, I wanted to just highlight for members that the bill as it's been drafted is consistent with the American Association of Motor Vehicle Administrators recommendations, which were in your packets. And frankly, that's the type of construct that we've been seeking to promote across the country, because continuity also is an important feature of motor vehicle definitions and regulation and so on and so forth. So I wanted to just assure you that what this bill would do, excuse me, has been thoroughly vetted by a number of other states, nearly two dozen, as well as subject matter experts, which have proposed and promoted this ANVA best practices for the regulation of three-wheel vehicles. Folks not only in motor vehicle agencies like DPS, but also the law enforcement side of that agency as well. So with that, I thank you.
Thank you. Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just to the committee members, if you looked at the House summary, the research summary and stuff, and does a great job of summarizing the bill. And then I also want to point out the fiscal note that was in your packet. That's kind of appealing, too. There's zero fiscal note on that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd say thank you to you and the committee for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Fabian. So I will move House File 3014 as amended be referred to public safety. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Name? All right, motion carries.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next bill we'll take up is House File 459, Chair Kelly's bill in regards to a Port Development Assistance Program. And I think we have a few testifiers, too, that are ready to get set up. I appreciate that. So with that, Chairman Kelly, are you ready to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I would like to move House File 459 and that it pass and be referred to capital investment. So, Mr. Chair and members, the House File 459 is an allocation of bonding dollars to recapitalize the Port Development Assistance Program. As we know, transportation takes many, many forms in the state of Minnesota, and the ports certainly have a vital role that they play. And when we can transport our
commodities and goods through the waterways, it's extremely important to so many jobs in the state of Minnesota. So I'm going to hand this over to Lori Lauder, who is St. Paul Port Authority, to discuss a few more things with the port.
Welcome, Ms. Lauder, and if you could state your name and position for the record, please.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. My name is Lori Lauder, Senior Vice President of Business and Intergovernmental Affairs at the St. Paul Port Authority. Thank you for your time today.
Go right ahead.
I'm speaking today on behalf of the Minnesota Ports Association. As you may be familiar with them, we've been in an association for around 22 years or so, and it exists with four ports: Winona, Red Wing, Duluth, and St. Paul. And on behalf of all of us, I wanted to thank you so much for your support in the past. We have really accomplished many projects, and we have a very long way to go as well. Mr. Chair, I would like to just read a statement and then take questions.
Go ahead.
The Port Development Assistance Program allows our public ports to maintain critical infrastructure so that we can continue to facilitate the movement of goods and products in and out of our harbors. And that's in and out of the state and through the Great Lakes system, as you know, with Duluth, as well as the Upper Mississippi Waterway system. The efficient transshipment of cargo through the Minnesota ports benefits many sectors of our state economy, and the Ports Development Assistance Program has been the primary means for the four ports to maintain our port infrastructure. And we are requesting $10 million in this for the combined ports association. I'd like to give a few examples of each port and some of the good work that we've done, and I'll try to race right through in the interest of time. First of all, the port of Winona. Winona removed a sunken barge which was disrupting the movement of traffic to and from their commercial dock, a very important project for them. They have replaced the barge mooring facilities and constructed a new mooring cell, as they're called, and rehabilitated their existing commercial dock wall. Winona also completed a dredging project which became part of a multimodal transportation improvement project for the community. Each of these upgrades has contributed to improved service and capability of the Winona port system. The Duluth Seaway Port Authority owns and manages multiple industrial properties and transportation infrastructure on behalf of the state, including the CLURE, that's C-L-U-R-E, CLURE Public Marine Terminal, the only general cargo facility and the only public terminal in Minnesota where small to mid-sized businesses can access international shipping channels and export their goods. Here's an example of leverage. Recently, $2.3 million in port development assistance funding was used by the Duluth Port Authority to leverage $10 million of U.S. Department of Transportation Tiger funds, as they're known, as well as $2.75 million of Duluth Port Authority funds as well, to do the following. They put a dock adjacent to the CLURE public terminal back into productive use that it had sat fallow for a very long time, and they linked it to a road and rail, so the multimodal feature is there, and accommodated heavy lift cargo and larger variety of cargo types. So this project will expand the capacity, create new jobs, and added opportunities to move commodities through the Great Lakes system in and out of the state. Next is Red Wing from the program, fundamentally changing traffic patterns while increasing the competitiveness of one of the city's largest employers. The state's investment, along with their local match, allowed the Red Wing unloading terminal to move from north of town to an abandoned dock at the south end of town. The old dock was resurfaced and an access channel which was dredged. Red Wing receives inbound cargo of slag, a byproduct of the steelmaking process, which is delivered to the USG plant just south of town. At my port here in St. Paul, our harbor has been very much impacted by the age of our dock walls. As you may have heard me say in the past, a lot of our dock walls have been constructed or were constructed during the WPA days of the 1930s. And even the ones that were built that were more modern from the 60s is beyond their 50-year asset life. So we have done a lot of dock reconstruction projects and some other infrastructure improvements thanks to this program. Certainly with the closure of the Minneapolis port, our port becomes very important as we might be able to take on some of those businesses because of that port closure. So we are now the uppermost port in the Mississippi system. In closing, Mr. Chair, I'd say that it's vital for the state's economic health to continue to have the ability to ship large quantities of cement, sand, salt, certainly agricultural products, and so forth that move in and out of the Twin Cities, a lot of them to global markets. So it's a real exporting system that we have. I wanted to leave you with this final quote. Waterborne commerce uses less energy, causes less environmental degradation, generates less waste disposal, and is responsible for fewer accidents, and is almost always cheaper. So we consider ourselves a big part of the intermodal system, and I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know in 2013-2014 we invested a lot in ports, as I recall. And then in the Lights On bill last year, I was alarmed because we were taking money out of the ports account, and now we're getting money for the bonding. And my question is, just to make sure I have this straight, was any of the money that was taken out of the ports account in 2015, could it have been used for this, or is it entirely different animal?
Ms. Lauder or Chairman Kelly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mason, I'm not exactly sure what you might be referring to as dollars taken out of the port, because actually we added dollars to the port last year.
Okay.
Representative Mason?
Maybe Mr. Lee could help us out.
Mr. Lee?
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, the Senate File 1647, which was the omnibus transportation bill that passed last year, spent $3 million in general fund for ports, for the Port Development Assistance Program. I'm not, I guess, aware of a port development fund. Typically, okay. That area is funded either from geo bonding or from a general fund appropriation.
Okay, and I haven't had time to do research. I just remember when we were going through the Lights On bill, I thought there was something being taken away from ports.
Maybe I think Representative Hausman has a
yes,
comment.
I remember it very well, because we sort of teased the opposing caucus because it wasn't taken from a fund, but there was a bill, and I don't know if it was the chair's bill, but it had an appropriation for ports, and I think a member of this committee took some of it for another purpose, and we teased a little bit about what they were doing to the chair, who has a little bit of an interest in ports. But I just wanted to make a point about the ports that I think we should be grateful for, and that is how well they work together. We give them a dollar amount, and it's always less than it ought to be. We hopefully always start with a big number, and it disappears. But they figure it out, the four of them, between them. And we never hear about internecine warfare or anything like that. The four ports have just worked so cooperatively together in terms of how they figure out how they're going to divide the money.
Members, we do have another committee right after us. So, Representative Mason, did you finish what you needed to ask?
Yeah, she's answered.
Okay, thank you so much for coming. And then, Chairman Kelly, do you want to renew your motion?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, members. I'd like to renew my motion that House File 459 be passed and referred to capital expenditures, capital portion.
Capital investment, correct.
Capital investment.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Just before we close, just an announcement. Monday the 21st, we will be reviewing the presentation on the Trunk Highway Dedicated Funds Report from the Minnesota Department of Transportation and the Department of Public Safety. So that is on our docket. That will be in Room 5. And with that, we are adjourned.